since this is about honesty, I have to be absolutely honest and tell you that I had a sneaking suspicion that by the time we got to this particular point in these proceedings, we would be slightly overloaded. And I also thought that I would have time somewhere in my journeys between Crete and Port Stewart and here to figure out just exactly what it was that John had on his mind when he asked me to address the question of honesty. It would be dreadfully dishonest if I were to tell you that I had accomplished that, and therefore the only thing I can do is tell you that I haven't accomplished that, and to let you know that my hope this evening is that in a kind of interactive way, we're going to be able to get at this subject. So it's going to be far more of a seminar in terms of the way that we would have enjoyed it at college or university, albeit it's a fairly large seminar group, but I think that we can have meaningful participation. And in terms of questions and comments and answers, that they wouldn't be, I may be the conduit for them, but I don't anticipate being the one who's going to be able to answer them all, that the combined wisdom is going to be the mechanism that we use to help one another. I want to begin by sort of rambling thoughts, followed by some biblical textual observation, followed by opening up the floor. To be back in Crete this weekend was a great privilege, or last week was a great privilege, and it brought to mind one of the most striking moments in my early days of trying to teach the Bible. And since it is directly related, this event, to the question of being honest in the way in which we open up the scriptures, I thought there would be value in mentioning it to you. I had been invited to the St. Ninian Centre in Crete, I was in my early 20s, to address the OMF Scottish Conference. Wallace was the OMF rep at that time, I think he was in London, and they had assigned me a title, which was Mission in the Last Days. They sent a letter and said, we'd like you to speak on Mission in the Last Days. So I said, okay, Mission in the Last Days. And I thought, where is there anything about the last days? And then I said, well, 2 Peter does that. And there's a little bit about mission there, I suppose. How many talks do I have to do? I looked back in and it said I have 3 talks to do. So I looked back at 2 Peter. I figured there are 3 chapters, 3 talks. I'll just expound 2 Peter. In my naivety and in my youthfulness, I'm going to tackle the whole of 2 Peter. And so I got there in the tea time hour. I think it was a Friday evening, and it was this kind of circumstance where we had had a meal, and that had straggled on a wee bit, and then eventually everybody got together in the conference center. And it was a fairly august group of people. There were folks there from New College. Philip Hare was there, who's now at Holyrood, and he was in his final year as a student. There were a group of them. Many of the OMF people were medics. Some were back from Thailand. Some were involved in different things. It was a very fine group of people. And I stood up to the thing at about this time on a Friday night at the end of a working week for everybody. The room was really hot, and I was really scared to death by the time I turned to the opening verses of 2 Peter 1. And I didn't go very far before I started to say things like, I'm sure you all know this. I know I'm only telling you what you know. In fact, I'm sure that many of you know much more about this than I know about it. I remember saying, what Peter is trying to say at this point is this, you know, and it just was unbearable. And the further I went, the more I bared my soul to these people, you know, with sort of calling out their sympathy. But in actual fact, I didn't really get any sympathy at all. It was nothing coming back. More like, you think it's bad for you, you ought to see what it's like for us. I mean, we came with a sense of expectation, and this is it. I mean, and well, you've done too, Peter. If you've tried it, even on a good day, it's bad. There was a gentleman sitting where Derek is sitting. He had a navy blazer on, gray flannels, black lace-up shoes. He had his leg, one leg across his knee, and he had his hand like this. And I was raised a little bit like this. And he sat underneath me, and he looked at me. And he never He never took his eyes off. And every time I would look away and look back, he's still looking at me. A bit like Dr. Spurgeon here. Look at this. Similar, see, look at that look. Look, see that? Similar to that look. Scary. And I finally dribbled to a conclusion. I mean, just dribbled to a conclusion. And prayed. And there was a door off here, and there was one of those folding bookcases that was the bookstall. It was kind of upmarket from this thing, but really not impressive. But it was there, and this is honesty. And so I thought, I'll get out here behind the bookcase, out the door, and in my room before I can see a soul or anybody can get me. So I said amen, and I went like that, and I'm just negotiating behind the bookstall, and boom, and right on the back of my neck like that, a hand, and I turn around, and it's the man with the navy blazer. And he moved his hand from my neck, and he put it around my shoulder, and he said, "Could I have a wee word with you?" Well, what was I going to say? No. I said yes. I immediately felt like I was caught by the headmaster. He said, "My name is David Patterson, and I'm on the council of the OMF in Scotland." Okay, fine, we've got the credentials. And he said, "I wanted to say one or two things to you about your preaching." I never met this man before in my life. And he said, "When you said about them making an abundant entry," he said, "that was very good." And I talked about them breaking down the wall. I got it out of the Tyndale commentary. You know, they broke down the wall for the entry of the person, and I had kind of hit a moment of usefulness in a long spell of chronic inertia. But anyway, he said that was very good, and then he said, "But really, that was all that was any good." And he said, I won't bore you with it, and I won't keep his Highland accent up, but he said, "What you did there was unacceptable." He said, "You stood up there and you deferred to everybody in the room. And furthermore, you said things like what Peter is trying to say." He said, "Peter wasn't trying to say anything. Peter was saying it. You were trying to say it. And there's a big difference." And then he said, "You need to know something, young man. When you stand up to the task of opening up the scriptures, you are God's man for that appointed moment. No one else in the room, only you. And whether you have a sirloin steak or a pound of mince facing you in your notes, you get up and you deliver it. Because for good or for ill, for better or for worse, this is God's word for God's people in that moment." And he said, "I'm telling you this tonight because I think that you might learn how to do this. But if you're going to learn how to do this, you must listen to what I'm saying. Now let me pray with you." And then he prayed with me. And I still ran to my room, the tears smarting out of my eyes, embarrassed, angry, disappointed, feeling like a fool, and knowing all the time I've got to go back again for the second one. And the second one I've already seen, and it's equally bad. And the third one, I don't even know. I can't even understand chapter 3. And I'm in my room like, "Lord, I don't know about eschatology, but any time this evening, I'm up for it, you know. Or if my race is run, my journey is done, whatever, I mean, get me out of St. Ninian's Center." I was in Dingwall in September preaching at the Scottish Northern Conference. And I was within shooting distance of the retirement cottage of the aforementioned David Patterson. So I had borrowed a car and I drove north up onto the Black Isle. And I went to the Free Church Manse and I inquired as to the whereabouts of this David Patterson. They sent me to a cottage down by the harbour. As soon as I knew where it was, I went to the co-op and I bought 2 sirloin steaks. And I went and I rang his doorbell and he came to the door and I said, I came from America with this for you, David. And he looked inside and immediately he said, is it steak or is it mince? and then he said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. So the message was not try and make your mince look like steak or whatever it was, but take what you have and offer it there. Not in a self abnegating way necessarily, but just in a straightforward way. I actually met him subsequently at Keswick when I spoke there 6 years ago and did 2 Timothy. And I did the first session, and I was just this comes to mind as I think of it now, but I did, it was belting with rain. And I did the first session, and I'm never ever content, and I certainly wasn't content with that first talk. And I thought, well, I'll run out of the door and I'll go out the back way here and I'll go away and I won't see anyone. Incidentally, in passing, I don't know how you guys feel, but preaching for me is not an energizing thing, it's an enervating thing. I don't finish with a sense of, I finish just as wishing I could be swallowed by a pavement. And the idea of shaking hands with everybody is tough. But anyway, so I was about to make a run for it, and as I made a run for it and opened the door of the kind of prefabricated structure you've been there, I went down 2 steps and was caught in a soaking royal blue cagoule, and a big cagoule just grabbed me like that as I went down the steps, and out of the mouthpiece of the cagoule came a voice saying, was it steak or was it mince? And then, it doesn't matter. Okay, so that's the first rambling thought. And believe me, there's some more where this comes from. All right. The whole idea of Philip Brooks' truth through personality, which often gives to us the sort of freedom of being ourselves, as it were, is, I think, it possesses an inherent danger that we think too much about personality and not about truth. That it is actually about the truth through a variety of personalities. It's not truth through personality. And if you think about that in relationship to, for example, Polonius, if you remember from Hamlet, you know, Polonius was such a bumbler and stumbler and went on at great length. How many of you did Hamlet for a level? None of you? 1 of you? 2 of you? Okay, here we go. You know, my liege and madam, to expostulate what majesty should be, what duty is, why day is day, night is night, and time is time, were nothing but to waste both night, day, and time. And since brevity is the soul of wit, and tediousness the limbs and outward flourishes, I will be brief. Your noble son is mad. Mad call I out, for to define true madness, what is but to be nothing else but mad? And then the queen interjects and she says, Polonius, more matter with less art. More matter with less art. And I think when we get to this Philip Brooks thing, this is my second rambling observation, people have a legitimate right to say more truth with less personality. Because the sort of self-authenticating postmodern Gen X, bearing your soul, sharing your narrative kind of preaching, which we're constantly told in the States is the only way now to legitimately preach, I think is just phenomenally man-centered. And the challenge, as John has set it out for us, of essentially letting people know that we stand before them as redeemed sinners who struggle. Letting the people know that we stand before them as redeemed sinners who struggle I'm not convinced that the place to let them know that primarily is the pulpit. I mean, I think my people know I am a redeemed sinner that struggles. They've played golf with me, many of them. They know that. They've seen me drive my car, unfortunately. They understand why Paul said to Timothy, watch your life and doctrine closely. They understand that what they have in front of them here is a struggle around the sea of life like themselves. I'm not sure that I need to, or we need to, find meaningful ways to sort of let this out and to tell our story. Because after all, that's not our mandate in preaching. Our mandate in preaching is to tell His story, not to tell our story. We don't have enough time to tell His story, so why would we intrude in it by the telling of our story? In fact, in preaching, as in everything else in the Christian life, surely the key to it is the laying aside of ourselves or the setting aside of ourselves and the taking up of the cross and preaching of the Lord Jesus Christ. I came across a story of an elderly lady who told someone who was visiting her that she knew when her pastor hadn't prepared his sermon. Paul said to the individual, how did you know that? She said, well, when he hasn't prepared his sermon, he starts crying at the weakest point in his sermon. So he's going along and eventually says, oh, I'm so overcome. I'm overcome with gratitude. And then the lady cynically said, he's usually overcome with gratitude about once a month, and it's usually related to his fishing schedule. The danger of self-authentication, and these are rambles as I'm saying to you, but the danger of self-authentication is a similar danger to the danger of the use of illustration. Because if we use illustration in a certain way, then we end up creating a mechanism whereby our people sort of go into they go into screensaver mode when we're doing any kind of exposition or exegesis, and they know only to press the button again and bring themselves back when you start. And there was a large Labrador dog that was wandering onto the railway line. They're like, oh, here we go, here, come on. That he's on the stuff now, he's on the business, you know. I said, but as you'll see in verse 14, you know, or the sermon begins, it was a hot day in Dallas. Oh, this is fabulous. Here we go. The air conditioner was not working. Oh, I love the one about the air conditioning. Now, even when we're trying to guard against that, we can do it. Some years ago now, I allowed myself a moment where I shouldn't have, and I was talking about people interfering in one another's lives in a way that was unhelpful, and I think I referred to it as spiritual nitpicking. And quite involuntarily, I said, have you ever seen monkeys? I've seen monkeys at the zoo. Have you seen how they do that to each other? How they go and they look in each other's heads and they look for things and then they find them and they bring them out and they show them to the person like that? I said, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Well, it wasn't that Sunday, but it was the following Sunday. I was walking around the corridor past the tape table. And just out of the corner of my eye, I heard somebody saying, I'm looking for the monkey sermon. Do you have the monkey sermon? So any attempt that I had, that I made, you know, trying to execute the person, nothing. No. I'm looking for the monkey sermon. All right? Now, the kind of things that I'm asking myself in relationship to this honesty are, and I'm coming to the text in a moment. There's always going to be a text somewhere. But is it legitimate to let people know that sometimes we're anxious if we're dealing with, you know, a passage on casting your burdens on the Lord or feeling a sense of fearfulness or whatever? I think probably, provided it just emerges quite naturally. It's not a focal point of anything. Because sometimes our folks think, you know, I don't think he probably is anxious. I think he just does 1 Peter 5:7 automatically. Cast his burden on the Lord, and the Lord sustains him, and that's the way it goes. Is it legitimate to let people know that we wake up at 3:30 in the morning and at this point in our lives, and we find that when we do, we can allow our minds to range all around the universe and be overwhelmed by all kinds of questions? I think probably, unless we're trying to draw attention to ourselves, because many of the men in the congregation who are in their early 50s, as I am, who've now found that they've reached the apex of their business career, who have found that their children have gone on and done what they've done, and they realise that they're not going any further, not going any faster, their golf game is getting a lot worse than it once was, and really they've got much less in front of them than they have behind them. They may think that somehow or another I've got a special key to dealing with all of those questions and uncertainties, but actually I don't. So if I was addressing that, I think I might be prepared to say so. What about temptation? And do they think that we're actually tempted, or do we just, are we immune to that? And should we let them know what, how, when? I don't know. I do know that, for example, I on one occasion, and I don't know motivated by what, but on one occasion I got caught for speeding while I was taking a pizza home in the evening. I was really infuriated by it. It ended up costing me about $60 for the pizza, you know, $10 for the pizza and $50 for the fine. And so I had this ticket which hadn't been paid, and then I was hurrying home. And in America, those of you who visited, you need to watch out for this. Although you're allowed to make a right-hand turn on a red light, given the flow of traffic, you're apparently not allowed to cut through. You know, you can't turn into the BP station 100 yards from the traffic light, nick round the back behind the petrol pumps, and come out on the other side. And I knew that, but I didn't want to remember that I knew it, because it was the next day and I was frustrated, and I wanted to get through that traffic light, and I had a number of people in front of me that didn't respond with gentleness, and it was bad. And so I said, and so I turned right and went through Pizza Hut, ran through Pizza Hut, past Dunkin' Donuts, out on the other side, and I'm just congratulating myself as I pull away, and I look in the rearview mirror, and the cops are behind me again with a light on. And it's not 24 hours since I got the $60 pizza. And so the fellow pulls me around, and as he's taking me off the road to get out and talk to me, and this is what I told the congregation, as he's taking me around, I said to myself, I can handle this. I'll tell him that I was going to Dunkin' Donuts. That's why I turned in there. I was going to Dunkin' Donuts, and then I changed my mind. And I just slipped out, and I was going to get a donut there, but no, I won't get a donut, then I'll go. And then the Spirit of God says, that'd be a flat-out lie, wouldn't it? And I said, yeah, but I got a $60 pizza on my hand. What am I going to do now? And you don't need to know the details of it, but I took the offensive when the guy showed up. I said, what? The guy said, pardon? I said, what? He said, well, you cut through the Pizza Hut and everything else. I said, hey. I said, you know, in America that's a crime. In Scotland that's called initiative. And he was like, you're from Scotland, are you? Yeah. You know, and as soon as I get them on the Scotland thing, they're home. But the point was, in telling that, it was obvious to the people, I mean, in a simple way, that I was actually tempted, flat out, right up tempted, to sin my soul and tell a lie and try and get myself out of the situation. And I felt it was okay to do that. Is it okay to let the people know we're sad? When I came back and after the death of my father, the week after the Keswick Convention 6 years ago, I felt that I preached on the death of Jacob or the death of Joseph, because I had to bring my congregation into this bit of my life. It had happened 3,000 miles away, but it was devastating to me, as it would be, I'm sure, you've experienced that. And so, yeah, it was sort of self-involved, but it was a crucial moment for the congregation, I felt, for me to be honest about the experience, about how what it meant and everything else. I recommend it as a pattern of existence. Everything that happens to me, I wanted to tell you about how it has affected me. But, I mean, there are certain things in life. And when it goes to the question of sin, you know these people in the church that come up and say, they tell you bad thoughts they've had about you, because they think that this is, well, they think it's cathartic or whatever else it is. I, maybe they only do it in America, but they come up and essentially, I just want to confess to you that I've always thought you were a pain in the neck, Alistair, and a number of other things. It's just completely deflating. I don't believe that we have a responsibility to confess our bad thoughts to people. That's between us and God. Let's get that sorted out. And in the same way, I don't have any conviction that there's any help derived in that public forum from that kind of thing, that sort of dropping your trousers approach, that sort of thing, that approach to the whole process. I don't like that at all. So just to be honest about that's my understanding of it, and maybe we can clear that up in a moment or two. The sphere of sin, I think, you know, where we have offended against someone in a public forum, we owe them a direct and straightforward public response. Where I've sinned against someone in my heart that is known only to God and to me, then that is between myself and God to get that cleaned up and move on. And I think it is illegitimate for me then to parade that in front of the congregation for any reason at all. Wesley and his group made sure that they held accountability with one another in relationship to these things, but they did it in a private way and in a personal way. They asked one another a number of questions. I don't remember them all. One of them was, when they met together, they would ask, which we would understand of Wesley, given the nature of his conversion and his spiritual experience, but they would ask one another, has there been an occasion since last we met when your heart has been strangely warmed? And they would address that. I was with a group of men, and I was encouraged, I was singing, and I was blessed, or whatever. Then they would ask one another whether they had been faithful and regular in their attendance upon worship and in their study of the scriptures. And then they would ask one another if they had faced some significant temptation, and if they had been victorious, and if so, how did they manage to be victorious? And had they faced any temptation in which they had been defeated? And if so, what had been the mechanism that brought about defeat? And if so, had they repented of that, and were they moving on? These are all very good and important questions, but they're questions not for a public forum, and certainly not for a pulpit, I'm sure we would agree, but for the private places of our lives. Now, with all of that, let me turn to 2 Corinthians with you. And just all I want to do is suggest that we are helped by Paul's approach here. And I think I went to 2 Corinthians first because Jeff said it would be a good place to start, and I trust his judgment. And secondly, after he suggested it, I thought more about it. And 2 Corinthians, of course, is one of the places in which Paul is forced almost to defend himself. You find out what it is he's responding to, for example, in 2 Corinthians 11. Not because he mentions the circumstances, but because of the way in which he says things. For example, the super apostles, he's addressing that in one way. The challenge that they were deceptive and so on, he addresses all of that. But let me just do this, and then I stop talking, and we open it up for conversation. This is really the best I could come up with in terms of any kind of apostolic example of honesty or openness. And of course, I'm sure you all know much more about this than I do. But anyway, here we go. Here we go. Let's look at verse 8, and I'm not going to make comment on it. I'm just going to point them out. We do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about the hardships we suffered in the province of Asia. In other words, we're not going to conceal the fact that we were up against it. 2 Corinthians 1. 2 Corinthians 1. Sorry, when I mentioned 11, that had nothing to do with anything. 2 Corinthians 1 and verse 8. So, hardships we suffered. And then he goes on in the verse to say, we were under great pressure. Actually, it took us beyond our ability. so that we even despaired of our lives. A very straightforward and honest statement concerning how he was responding to the circumstances. He takes it further when he says, indeed in our hearts we felt the sentence of death. But we've actually concluded that this happened, and this fits with the weakness power thing we've been dealing with, this happened that we might not rely on ourselves but on God who raises the dead. And then in verse 11, where he makes the reference to, as you help us by your prayers, he's basically saying to them by inference, and I want you to know, we depend upon your prayers. Okay? We don't want you to be uninformed, but in fact, we're glad to let you know, great pressure, beyond our ability, despairing of our life, feeling the sentence of death, and we actually depend upon your prayers. You go into chapter 2 and verse 4. When I wrote to you, I wrote out of great distress and anguish of heart and with many tears. Pretty honest statement there. You know, this is the sense of his compassion for them. And I did that not to grieve you, but actually to let you know the depth of my love for you. He's prepared to do that. In 1 Thessalonians, you know, he said, we were gentle among you as a mother with her children. We got down to where you were. We treated you the way a dad would treat his children too. Verse 13, still in chapter 2, 2 Corinthians 2. You know, I went to Troas. The Lord had opened the door for me. But I wasn't at peace. I still had no peace of mind. And I'll tell you why. Because I didn't find Titus. What is he telling us? He's telling the Corinthians that for him relationships matter. He's not a stoic. He's not a one-man band. He makes that clear in all his letters, doesn't he? The end of 2 Timothy. Get this and get that. And what about Demas and good old Luke? And Mark's a good boy. And he runs through all this list. Very often I think we can come across as, you know, we're... I am a rock, I am an island, and a rock can, don't feel no pain, and an island never cries. You know. But not Paul. He's prepared to open up in that regard. And then in verse 16, when he talks about, you know, being the aroma of Christ, and to one the smell of death, to the other the fragrance of life, and then he just remarks, he says, you know, who's equal to this kind of thing? And then when he goes into chapter 3, he points out that when it comes, and it really follows on from the question, who is equal to this thing? He says, if we're confident at all, our confidence is through Christ before God. And then he says, of course, you should understand that we're not competent in ourselves to claim anything for ourselves, because our competence comes from God. Even to chapter 1, I'm not going to keep this up, just two or three more verses, but into chapter 1, he says, therefore, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart. He says that again, incidentally, in verse 16, therefore we do not lose heart. Do you get the sense that he's kind of talking to himself there as well? If he says we do not lose heart, and it's something to be remarked upon, then it surely is an indication of the fact that he knows the potential of losing heart. And that God in his goodness has helped him not to lose heart. So in other words, he's letting us know that he could lose heart. That he could become faint-hearted. And he takes us into that. But we're not losing heart. And we want you to know that we're on the up and up. We want to tell you that we're being straightforward. I think in terms of things with our people, sometimes it's good for us just to let them know. You know, we want you to know that if you could come and see our checkbook, if you want you to know, this is a tangential launch, I understand, but we ought to be able to say, you can see my checkbook stubs, you can come on and see the record of my laptop. You can have my laptop for a month and you can go through it. I want you to know. And God is my judge, and you'd strike me dead if I tell you a lie right now, you know what I mean? I'm telling you straight up. So that our people know that at least in our hearts, at the core level, we're serious about the whole question of purity and integrity and everything else. I know he's talking about the gospel here. We don't use deception. We're not involved in distortion. We're not actually involved in diluting the word either. And of course, we want you to know, verse 5, that we don't preach ourselves. And someone says, well, it's sounding a lot like you are preaching yourself, Pastor. Well, then I need to be rebuked. I need to be helped with that, because I'm not intending to preach myself. I want to preach Jesus Christ as Lord, and I want to learn to be a servant. I want to learn to be your servant for the sake of Jesus. And then you can go on. We didn't need to go on. We have the treasure in jars of clay. And then he says, if you want to know how it's really going, we're hard pressed on every side, verse 8. We're not crushed. We're perplexed. We're persecuted. We're struck down. We're getting a hammering. We're alive, being given over to death, and so on. Now, when he does all of that, you set that alongside, if you like, what he's prepared to say in 1 Corinthians 4. I didn't mean to say this, and this is definitely the last thing I'll say. But it comes to mind now. In 1 Corinthians 4, when he's dealing with his apostleship and the sense of responsibility and privilege that accompanies it, he says, if we think about how people ought to regard us, let's be honest. They ought to regard us as servants of Christ, as those entrusted with the secret things of God. They have a legitimate right to anticipate that we will prove faithful. Servants must. And then, this is quite striking to me, and I think it's important as well. And we want to be cautious with this. But look at what he says. I care very little if I'm judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I don't even judge myself. My conscience is clear. That doesn't make me innocent. It's the Lord who judges me. And I think from observation, well, I can think of somebody right now who set up an accountability group with his elders in a quest for honesty, was honest with them about his own personal struggles, and they got rid of him. The very mechanism that he created in order to engage in honest dialogue about the things of the faith and his own walk with God, they used as a mechanism to boot him out the door. And while I'm prepared, we want to be prepared to not make an attempt at authentic preaching, because there's nothing more inauthentic than trying to be authentic. But it's like trying to be humble. That's Uriah Heep. When our faces shine, we don't know. When we're humble, we think we're not. Certainly not about trying it. And authenticity or clarity or transparency or integrity will never be a contrived thing. Our wives can help us. Our closest friends can help us. But what I'm saying here is this. Unless we get to the point where our consciences are clear in the exercise of our duties, and we can, not in a bombastic way, and maybe not even verbally, but at least in our hearts, say, you know, I can't let Mrs. Jenkins' concerns about the organ fund really control the destiny of the music ministry in this church. And I know she thinks I'm a bad rascal, but I really don't care if Mrs. Jenkins thinks I'm a bad rascal right now. I don't frankly care if I'm judged by a human court. I put my head on the pillow tonight. My conscience is clear. Of course, I know my heart. I know how perverse I can be. I know that doesn't necessarily make me innocent. But we have to let our congregations know that as well. Especially if we're in what we call congregationally governed churches. Because our very honesty, our very attempt at transparency, maybe become the very sword on which we fall. So there's all kinds of challenges in it. Well, that's enough. Is that all right, John? Clem? Shall we, Clem? To you. You're in charge.
Do you want me to turn
down? Yeah, well, do whatever you want to do. Yeah, and I can sit down.
Would you like to sit up here?
No, I can just stand up here beside you.